Well, good morning, everybody. Let me do a little sound check here. They're here listening to Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio, broadcasting from Shepherdstown, West Virginia, and atop the Four Seasons bookstore right in the middle of Shepherdstown. And let me see whether... can you hear anything? Okay, well, we're going to fix that here. Testing on Tom. Do you hear anything there? Testing. There you go. Now you're good. Hold on a second here. Can you hear?
Yeah, I can.
Okay.
Good morning, everyone.
No, you're not on. Your mic's not on yet.
Oh, never mind then.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right. Okay. So we're gonna.
No morning yet.
Is that too loud, Tom?
No, it sounds good.
Okay. When you talk, you're gonna have to get a little closer to the microphone, talk in a normal voice. And sorry about the geography in here, but that's just the way it goes. Okay, folks. So, Tom, talking to the microphone for a minute, could you please? We're doing a sound check here.
Good morning.
It'd help if I had it on. Try once again, Tom.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Oh, that's looking good. And see, Mr. Cucarini.
Good morning, everyone.
Okay, I could keep yours down because your voice is so resonant.
Yeah,
it could fill a mountain valley.
You're listening to Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio on enlightenedradio.org.
No, enlighten.
I said enlighten.
I heard an ED on there.
No. I'm very cautious to not use the ED.
ED has been banished.
It has, because there's...
Reminds me of...
That's Joel, what's his name's, the big religious guy. Has a,
Osteen?
Yeah, Joel Osteen's, I think, inspired... website, I believe.
All right.
So we don't want to be confused with that guy. So
no.
But no. You're listening to Eastern Panhandle Independent
the Poetry
Community
Show.
The Poetry Show.
All right. Now I just want to remind everybody that if you should hear, I got an email once from the head of Netscape when I was working for Netscape, the email was not a long one. But the main feature of it was that there were no vowels in any of the words. And Jim Barksdale was his name. He was the CEO of Netscape in its heyday. So everyone said, well, why did you leave all the vowels out? And he says, well, Microsoft sent me a note saying they own all the vowels. And I have to pay them. I have to pay them to use them. That was his little joke about being put out of business by Microsoft. Anyway, welcome to the Poetry Show this morning. Our guest is Tom Donlan, who's been on this show when it was broadcasting over Shepherd University Radio several times. My good friend and co-host Janet Harrison has been taking care of her family now, going on 8 weeks, actually. It's been a very difficult situation with her daughter-in-law, who had a serious surgery and complications, just all kinds of things. Anyway, it's just, occasionally in families you run into these healthcare nightmares, and it's a struggle, you know, to keep everything together. Anyway, she sends us her love and her wisdom, and then, of course, she might be a slight bit jealous that Ed Zanheiser... you know, became more active recently and last few weeks, and I don't know what to do about, you know, the poetic temperament when it gets into competitive mode, but in any event, we have to just learn to love it, I guess, in one way or another. So and Tom, who has stood in several times here when Janet was away as well,
we'd like to send our best wishes and positive thoughts and prayers to Janet and her family. I just want to make sure that, you know, I didn't get a chance to do that before, and I just, you know,
she's a sweetheart.
She's a sweet lady,
and she went all the way through and got herself a master's of fine arts in poetry from Spalding University, which is one of these part-time residency, part-time remote web-based programs. And she got a lot out of it. She really loved the poets who were teaching there and who were and who took a lot of time with the students and you know, getting them to get, you know, with their work, and a lot, you know, they make you work yourself to death, you know, on those kind of things. But I remember once I had a problem in computer science that I was in a graduate program in Pennsylvania. And the professor gave me this book of problems, you know, that was going to be the problem thing for the course. And it looked like a fairly old book by the time I checked it out of the library. But in any event, I started working on the first one, you know, he had assigned us, and I could get absolutely nowhere with it. I mean, it was like, you know, you worked it 15 different ways, doing every mathematical technique that you'd acquired, you know, so far anyway. And it was just, you know, just the road was full of mud. Let's put it that way. So I went back to him and I said, well, is there an answer to this thing anywhere? He says, well, no, that's a book of unsolved algorithmic problems. And I said, oh, unsolved? And he says, yes, you're in a graduate program. You're supposed to be able to do something new. Yeah. You know, that's the entire point. He started lecturing me. I said, okay. He says, keep working on it, you know. Anyway, so something said to the value of challenging study. Anyway, welcome to the program, Tom Donlan, and welcome back. It's good to see. I see you have a published chapbook here called Peregrine, and I'm going to get you to read from it at some point. Hopefully you're going to read from this at some point here.
Absolutely.
But I've been starting off each poetry show recently with a Janet's Christmas present to me.
Oh.
Which she gave me early, all right, which is the All the Odes of Pablo Neruda, okay? And it turns out that Neruda, at one point, became enamored of the ode, you know, basically a poem of praise. It has other features, too, but that would be... And it's okay. You can sometimes praise things that are don't sound very praiseworthy, but they are always sort of pictured as, well, they may not be that praiseworthy, but they're more praiseworthy than the alternative, you know, like an ode to dejection. things like that. Anyway, so Neruda decided to write one every Sunday. And he did so for 225 Sundays. In addition to other stuff. And he never himself published them in, you know, like a book of odes or anything like that. Some of them were sprinkled throughout other publications that he did. But he did them over a long range of his substantial thing of his life. And, you know, 7 or 8 years. And they reflect his Sunday morning thing. And this one is called The Ode to Rain. The rain returned. It didn't come from the sky or out of the west. It came straight from my childhood. Night split open. A peal of thunder rattled. The racket swept every lonely corner. And then the rain came. Rain returning from my childhood. First, a raging gust, then a planet's soggy tail. The rain goes tick-tock, 1,000 ticks, 1,000 tocks. A sleigh or an ample burst of dark petals in the night, suddenly intense, riddling the leaves with needles. Other times, it's a stormy cloak, drifting down in silence. Rain, sea of the upper air, fresh, a naked rose, a voice of the sky, a black violin, a sheer beauty. I have loved you since childhood, not for your goodness, but for your beauty. I trudged along in my ruined shoes, while threads of streaming sky unraveled over my head, bringing a message from on high to me. And to roots, humid oxygen, freedom of the forest. I know how mischievous you can be. The hole in the roof, dripping measured drops on poor people's rooms. That's when you rip off the mask of beauty, when you're as mean as heavenly armor or a dagger of transparent glass. That's where I really came to know you. But I was still yours in love in the night. Shutting my eyes tight, I hoped you would fall on the world. I hoped you would sing for my ears alone. Because my heart cradled the earth sprouting, in my heart metals merge, what springs out of my heart. But loving you still left a bitter taste in my mouth, the bitter aftertaste of regret. Just last night, here in Santiago, houses in Nueva Laguga collapsed. Fragile mushrooms, heaps of humiliation. But because of your heavy footsteps, they fell. Children cried in the mire, and day after day in rain-soaked beds or shattered chairs, the women bonfires for kitchens, while you, black rain, enemy rain, kept on falling on our misery. I believe that someday, a day we will mark on our calendars, they will live under sound roofs, dry roofs, men with their dreams, everyone who sleeps. And when in the middle of the night the rain returns from my childhood, it will sing for other children to hear, and the song of rain falling on the world will be joyous. And it will be industrious, too. Anyway, that's a longer poem, but that's a significant segment of it. Anyway, I like these odes that that's something about Neruda. When I listen to them, I take more note of what's going on around me. Anyway, welcome to the program, Tom. And tell me what you've been doing with yourself, and tell me about how this book chapbook came together.
All right, if I can jump back for a second here, you're talking about algorithms.
Yeah,
I worked with a guy named Al Gore.
Okay.
Not the same one you're thinking of. But he was making algorithms.
Oh, he was. Yeah, he was. It's a complicated thing. You know, there's one of the things I found out is that there is a problem. There is a set of problems in algorithmic science that are known to be solvable. Not all of them have been solved, but they're known to be in a. If you can prove that they're in the category of a solvable problem, then your only problem is to transpose the problem into the solvable one.
Okay.
Okay. And so that's the class of possibles. Okay. And then there's the class of unknowns, where it's not known whether or not you can satisfy the requirements of the solvable known solvable ones. But you can see how it just becomes a very deep well pretty quickly.
I can fix leaking roofs. That's about as far as I can go probably with that.
Well, if it hadn't been for a leaking roof, would Jesus and Mary and Joseph have seen the star above them?
I don't know.
Anyway, welcome to the program.
Thanks again.
Tell me about your book and your travels here.
Well, I'm still working full time, and there's a place in Ranson I go to get my car work done, and I walked in there and I told them retirement is when I come here to get my tires replaced. And they laughed and laughed, and they put a placard up on the wall saying that.
No kidding. Okay, there you go, man. That's right. You know,
but I have lots of kids and lots of responsibilities still. In fact, I got a master's in fine arts over 30 years ago.
Right. From University of Maryland?
American U.
American University. Yeah. American University. Right.
But Henry Taylor, my mentor, came to my wedding, and he was concerned about my poetry career. But I've managed finally to send him this chapbook.
Oh, that's is he? What did he reply?
Not yet. But, and also Myra Sclareux, another well-known DC area poet, responded, and she and Henry basically were my mentors at AU.
Wow. Wow.
So they didn't waste their time. But, yeah, this chapbook, I actually submitted a 100-page manuscript for a contest, and I was a finalist. And I submitted it again, and I think I was a finalist again. But one of the judges offered me this chapbook, which is a cut-down version of it.
Oh, okay. All right.
So
all right.
It was 100 pages. Now it's 33.
Probably a cost-benefit analysis of some sort. I don't know. Can you do that with poetry books? I'm not sure.
There's a couple of ways to look at that. Some people will never read 100 pages, so 33 they'll read.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Could be.
I'm thrilled, and I was awarded 250 copies of it, and I've been, you know, basically handing them out to friends, writers.
Well, I'm glad you gave it to us. I'm seriously. I mean,
thank you, sir.
And
yes. I can, appreciate it. Thank
because
you.
Now I can add it to the other pile. See that I have here, you know, of odes, you right. know, that can get read. Now, Janet, before her family disaster, she was going to work on a chapbook from stuff that she had done in connection with her mentors at Spalding.
Uh-huh.
But I think this is perhaps postponed it. But I know she has. She has a little collection that she's been working on with one of her Molly. What's her name? The poet Molly.
Yeah.
There you go. See, there.
I know who you're talking about.
is it Pitchner? Molly. No, I don't know.
No, that's not it.
No, that's from an old song.
Yeah,
that sounds different. Like a Beatles song.
Yeah, it does.
From
it
Rubber Soul era.
It does. Yeah,
but anyway,
but we featured Janet's poems on the Fluent magazine.
That's right.
She's
got
some great stuff.
Anyway, I know she's been working, but she's taking care of her grandson and her daughter-in-law, down in Richmond. But hopefully she's going to get a break over Christmas, and we send her our love. Why don't you read something from, and at some point I hope we get to the one that you did with me, trying to teach me about how to do a villanelle. By the way, after we did villanelles on the program, I think Janet did Gozzles too, which were even more interesting. And then I finally got tricked into I got it that it was a joke pretty quick, you know, but the paradel I also got into a little bit, you know, but okay.
Well, we've restarted the Bookend Poets on the second Thursdays now of the month.
Right.
And I have been academically away from poetry for so long that I misunderstood the definition of enjambment. And I had to get Ed to help me out. And I thank him for getting me out of a jam. But anyway.
Well, you can't leave the listener with that little teaser. You're gonna explain what enjambment is. Right?
Well, when you think of jam, you're thinking like, okay, you're kind of stuck or something. But no, actually, an enjambment means the line trickles on to the next without having a hard stop.
Okay.
Ed clarified that. But anyway, I hope to retire one day and get back to poetry.
Well, retirement is, I hope you've, being conservative in your investments, whatever your 401k or pension benefits are, I see volatility everywhere myself. So, a little troubling. But I'm collecting Social Security right now, and my pension, from the union was pretty good. And so, I mean, so far, they're not out of business. I'm hopeful that we continue on, but
I'm completely screwed.
You are. See, entertainment is
sorry.
Wrong anyway.
Yeah.
All right. I've got a 401k that at one point was about a 201k.
Yeah, right.
But
yeah.
It's getting back up there.
Really that much?
Oh, but he,
you stop bragging, Tom.
Well, the financial crisis hit a lot of funds very bad.
We've gone through two retirements just to exist.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had to. There was no, and we were penalized for that.
Well, that's the reason why we won't go into labor union politics right now. But anyway, but no. Go ahead.
No, let's get on with it.
All right, this collection of poems, actually I told you it was 100 pages and I had to cut it to 33 to meet the chapbook criteria. I was unable to do that, as in the words of William Faulkner, kill your darlings. I wasn't able to do that.
you had to farm that job out.
So mm-hmm. my wife did it for me. she did a really good job. But these are, you know, a lot of years of work here, and it covers the range of, you know, I got a bunch of kids. It's kind of a spiritual journey. There's also a lot of disaster and war stuff. Like, you know, how do you explain all that stuff? But anyway, I can start with the opening poem, which is called Rush Hour and a Half. You make this run 5 days a week, the office 60 miles from the country. You slalom at dawn down the Blue Ridge, one car and a string of pearls down Route 9 to where the work is, down a two-lane, tree-lined, state-maintained, oh, never the same since you hit a deer, every glimmer doe-eyes, every mailbox a buck. You sip coffee, scan soybean fields, listen to books on CD. Out of the woods you merge, soft pedal for a place in the bypass, stiffen. The guy next to you is shaving. Everyone passes a school bus, the road grader. Close to the city, pace slows, crawls, toll road, you merge. Each car in turn is a zipper closing. Here you are, sitting still, a lady powders. A man reads the news. Someone enjoys a bagel. On the roadside, gems glitter, shards of headlight, clusters of rubies, diamonds, shimmering chrome, bumper stickers. One more dopeless hope fiend, says one. Live right, eat well, die anyway, another. We are in this together, solving clues on personalized license plates. We quietly drive, stay between the lines, swerve when we must, follow this road because we know no other.
Well, I would say that GPS might find another longer route.
Right.
You know, for you. I like that one, though. Yeah. I like the...
Well, it kind of kicks off the journey.
The line that sticks out to me is everyone passes the school bus.
Yeah.
Now, you wisely omit to mention whether or not it still had its stop sign.
No, I was catapulted back to my commuting days, you know, living in Woodbridge, Virginia, and commuting to Crystal City initially, and then to to downtown DC, and then to Reston from Woodbridge, which was just back in the day. That was crazy. That was a long commute.
Well, when I go down to work, I go 40 miles to Ashburn.
Yeah.
But the guy who lives in Mount Vernon takes him twice as long as it takes me.
Wow. Yeah, my wife is currently working on my wife is working on a temporary job right now. She commutes to close to the north part of Ashburn, so it's not quite, you know, it's between 45 and an hour depending upon traffic. So, although there was some really bad stuff, she wasn't very happy the other night. It was about 3.5.
Yeah.
A lot of accidents.
So, one more dopeless hope fiend, or live right, eat well, die anyway. I mean, are those just the bumper stickers that stick in your mind? You know, are they real?
They are real.
I mean, I've seen the dopeless hope fiend.
Oh, yeah.
I like the live right, eat well, die anyway.
I
like that one.
Yeah, it's always good.
There are many, but those stuck out.
Those stuck out, right. Yeah, yeah, okay. I mean, that's... And, you know, I think it's true. Once you've hit... Here's the problem. I haven't actually hit a deer, but I've been hit twice by a deer.
Yeah.
Yeah, a deer committed suicide on my wife's old SUV as well. Slammed right into the side of it.
And, yeah, I mean, I thought maybe... Is that because it's like buck season and they see the headlight coming down the road and they think it's something to charge? I don't know deer psychology that well, but
I hit a 12-point buck on the Dulles tow road going 65 miles an hour.
I don't even mind.
Folded the whole front of my car.
You totaled your car, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, if you want distinctions, that was probably the same sort of thing where the deer ran out of the woods, hit the front end of my car.
But it does. It makes you very sensitive. I mean, I drive here almost every day along Bakerton and River Road from Harper's Ferry. And I go... 25 to 30 miles an hour, which is actually the speed limit, by the way.
Right.
But I am frustrating all kinds of people who want to zoom past me. I said, there's nothing but a deer waiting for you down this road, pal. And I just can't now. I can't speed up because I've had two incidents now where it's one time the deer didn't die. It sideswiped me and knocked my side view mirror off.
Right.
Wow.
And then stumbled down across the field or something. Yep. But the other one was more serious. So anyway, yeah. Let's do another one. I wanted to ask you. Now you have. I mean, this is a structured, let's see, 4, 8, 10. This is a little bit like a...
The Anglo-Saxon?
A sonnet, kind of.
It's called a sestina.
A sestina. Okay.
Yeah, it's
okay. Which goes back to when?
I think like the 1100s.
So this is...
Wow.
Again, people today don't recognize you. I mean, congratulations that you recognize it was a four.
It was just something. Well, I counted the lines on three. I mean, you know, I should have remembered sestina, but I didn't. Okay.
But I just spent 2 years in a full-time graduate program writing these things, learning how to write these things. And it's almost like, to me, you have to know the rules before you break the rules. But
But
on occasion, I'd like to go back to these antique forms. And a sestina has six words that repeat at the end of the lines.
Oh, okay. Six words that repeat. So in this case, it's...
And there's a specific order for those six words. And then that the last three-line stanza, all six of those words appear.
Oh, I see. Yeah. That's a little bit like a Ghazal-like, too. The Ghazal has that... has something about that too. You know, I got to go back. You know, when I get some time on this radio station, by the way, you're listening to Epic Radio, the poetry show here on Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio. We're broadcasting from Shepherdstown, West Virginia, above the Four Seasons Bookstore, right in the middle of German Street.
And our call line is
304-885-0708. If you want to call, let me make sure that I've got the mix number right on here so that if a call came in, we might hear it. Oops. Well, you have to turn off the automation in order to not hear it, but only hear Mike Diesel when he calls in. Oh, wait, Mike's here.
Cool. Hold on a second.
There we go. All right. Okay. Well, let's do another poem.
All right. This one, I'll do a shorter one here. It's called Skull, and this is a local to this county poem. Jawless, it rolled from an earth pile after rain at the elementary school construction site. Workers laying pipe thought it was a rock. Work stopped. Police wrapped the area with tape. The grated ground covers sinew and bone, synapse and cell. An African-American girl pre-Civil War lost her lowest denominator. Even when my lab died, I curled her paws in rest before I shoveled earth on her. The tape is gone. Sewer pipe is in. Grass grows. Skeletal frames of scaffolding aid masons who lay block for walls. Soon a curving road will sing with busloads of children packed for school. She seeks her parts, breastbone, widening pelvis, and someone to tell what left her there alone and apart. You will hear, young one, bursts of laughter, children on swings, their ears open to hear a field that speaks.
Wow. So, do you think burial grounds are sacred? And what does that mean?
Well, again, this is all part of the spiritual journey in this book. I mean, I can't imagine that just a skull lying there means nothing else. I think there's something there with it. You know, I'm not sure there's a wandering soul looking for the rest of the skeleton, but I just believe that there's something to our makeup besides just elements.
But my question really has to do with, I mean, we've seen many, many, many graveyards.
Yeah.
Upturned by progress. Let's call it that, for lack of a better term.
I don't agree.
And at some point, well, if the graveyard is deep enough and you don't know about it, I guess it doesn't matter, maybe. If it does, and they're living witnesses to it still around, they obviously get upset. I mean, I'm thinking about the dispute, for example, in the Native American lands up there. And I think there have been some others in the past, too, where some ancient site is thought to be sacred, and they're therefore, don't step here.
No,
go around. So I'm just wondering how, but we're quite a bit selective about how our feelings are about that sometimes, aren't we? I mean, it's hard not to build on top of the past. When do you designate a building as this must be preserved and not, not touched, by future development or something like that? I mean, that's a tough. There's a spiritual element in that question, right?
Yeah. This one elementary school, I don't know how that girl's body got there, but yeah, I would say, yeah, that's a sacred thing.
My wife worked on a case in Frederick when she was a reporter there, she was a journalist there for the Gazette, that where they were going to develop over an historic African-American graveyard. And she helped expose that because they were trying not to tell anyone and kind of keep it all cloak and dagger kind of thing. And she exposed that. She actually wrote a story about it several years ago. And activists all got together and kind of, no, you're not going to. We have to come to some kind of a. And they were able to actually reach a little bit of an agreement to move where that development was going to be. And that was a good thing. But I think there is some. I think you're right. I think they should be considered to a certain extent sacred. We have to honor that. We have to be careful. It's frightening to know that children. What's striking is the laughter of other children. I mean, it's not their fault. You know what I mean? It's just kind of the contrast of finding a skull, right, where children play and learn and become educated and start to become human beings and develop into who they're going to be. And that's kind of frightening.
Thinking about your lab.
Yeah.
That was, that's nice. So this is a, four stanza poem and each with four lines each. And so, I don't notice any direct rhymes, but,
I would call it open form. There's no specific form that's attached to it. It's just that I put the material together in four lines each, and it just seemed to work out that way.
I heard a slight rhythm as you read it. Was that deliberate or conscious? Maybe not quite a meter, but...
poetry needs to be different from regular prose. And ancient poetry, as you know, is all about music and rhythm.
Yeah. Well, an oral tradition. How else would you remember things?
Right. The ancient Greeks had a specific rhyming meters and rhyming patterns and things, right? So they could remember the words. But yeah, so I just like to stay with some of the elements of poetry, rhythm and sound. I do internal rhymes sometimes where ends of lines are too obvious.
Right.
It's
right.
Hard. Yeah, these days it's hard. Well, you'll see in that Villanelle, it's hard to... justify rhyme to some people these days.
Well, I think rhyme it can, at its best, equal resonance. Okay.
Yeah.
In other words, it's like in a song, right? I mean, and in songwriting.
Right. Songwriting.
I mean, both the rhythm, even though you can squeeze words into a beat, into a musical beat. Okay. That on a page you can't quite squeeze them. I'm sorry, that's 10 syllables. Man, not the way I sing them. Yeah, kind of thing. So songwriting's a little different. I'm thinking about Bob Dylan's very curious letter that he wrote. Have you read it yet to the Nobel Committee?
I've not.
Well, I'll send it to you. I recommend it. It's you know, it's pure Bob, you know. but he and it has both the high and the low, right? You know, he draws a comparison. He compares himself, of course, with Shakespeare. Well, who never received a Nobel. Anyway, that business about the poetry, see, here's the difference between you and Emily Dickinson now. You are a published poet in your lifetime.
And I refer to her in one of these poems in here.
Oh, well, that might be interesting. And she, now we had Dr. Heidi Hanrahan here last week. We're talking about Emily Dickinson. Mike is moving around the room, we can tell. anyway, she was saying that, of course, nothing in Emily Dickinson's poetry, except for some that she mailed to some people. I guess there were a couple published in the Atlantic. But most of it was unpublished, and thereby it's very difficult in some cases to resolve possible conflicts. In some areas she had alternative lines or alternative words in a line that she left in her notes, and some were written on the back of envelopes. And, well, what part of the envelope do you read first? Things like that. And so now you're a published poet, and you're, you know, so now your poem is a little bit, you know, now a little bit maybe like Shakespeare's play. Okay, in other words, he never really intended his play to be read. He intended it to be heard, right, in a theater, and he wrote it for certain actors, perhaps, you know, to a play. And should I have the king be in Denmark or here at home in England? I mean, you had these, you know, these things that when you do something publicly, there might be consequences and externalities of various kinds you have to consider, right?
Hard to revise when it's
you're told that you cannot put the 100 poems in, you have to put 30. But what if the internal narrative you had actually required 80 to complete? as a published poet, this is what everyone will see, okay, slightly modified from your original work, quote unquote, by externality. Go ahead.
Yeah. A couple ways to look at that. Some people rush to print, and they later think, oh my God, I should have revised this stanza, that stanza.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of mine are aged, so that I've had time to look.
Been sitting in the barrel a while, yeah.
But right. But once it's published and it's in paper form, that's what it is, you know.
Wow. And,
but I mean, there's a saying that the poem's never finished. You know, you just stop writing it at some point. And so maybe Emily Dickinson was like that, but she does offer us some wonderful stuff.
Oh, just, yeah, this beautiful, beautiful stuff. Let's do one more, and then let's take a short break, okay?
Okay. Again, this is a mix of, there's war poems, disaster poems, and family poems and things in here, but one you'll remember. Should I read the tsunami?
Oh, yeah, that one. Yeah. I read
that. This is a shape poem. In other words, a shape like a wave. And the tsunami was just so overwhelming. I couldn't even fathom. Oop, that's a pun. I couldn't even figure out how to think about it. So I just took the word itself and made a poem out of the word tsunami. The syllables, smooth, smooth as water, swish through the wind of your mouth, roll out like a wave. Tsunami, tsunami. Sue, 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 you purse your lips, blow out the name. Sue, 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 soothing, smooth. Say it slowly. Na, na, na. The crest rises, rises, hauls back the coastal waters. Whoosh, pulls off the clothes of the shoreline. Comes in fast, fast, and low, low. Too fast to see, to see. Hello, hello. Me, 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 the receding, receding into the mouth of its leaving, oh, the delirious, inconsolable grieving, grieving, the muddy littoral, the littoral is leaving. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye into the deep oblivious blue sea, the sea. Villages and towns are missing. Tsunami, tsunami, tsunami. Where can the missing ones be? The little ones, the little ones.
Okay, so now you've really done something with this, the shape of this poem on the page. This is not one of those where you can read it forward and reverse in the
right. It actually started as a kind of like the skull poem as stanzas, and I thought, no, let's do something different here.
Right, right. But it's and you have that hole in the middle.
I think that's probably just the typo. It should have been spaced better.
Oh, I see. I see. Oh, yeah. Okay. I got you. All right. And well, now this is a poem that could be put to music. That's the first thing that occurs to me.
Yeah, I mean,
that's an interesting thing.
I had a songwriter ask me to give him some words for a song, and I put them in the form of a poem, and he took them completely into the form of a song from my poem, which is, as we were talking about earlier, the rhythm and the sound.
The resonance, yeah.
Repeated words and things.
Well, you know, like Springsteen always tries to put, well, after he got over writing small books for songs. Okay. that was a youthful enthusiasm. But later, he got, as he did more performing, right? I heard him talking about this. By the way, his new book is just unbelievably good.
Born to Run.
Yeah. And he's actually a very literate guy and amazing, you know, that he's sort of self-taught a little bit, but a very interesting fellow. Anyway, he started putting into his songs things that you would that would allow the audience to sing along, mm-hmm. Okay? And if they would do that, it would make them remember the song forever, okay? If you could get something like that going, right? So he has in his, I think he did it in 2008 when he did put out this thing for Obama, The Rising. You know, and he put right in it, na 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 na. Well, people, you can't forget it.
Well, I mean, if you say,
so that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, yeah. If you hear, you know, him, the one, you know, come on, put your hands in mine. You know, let's join hands and
yeah. I mean, he does.
It's almost it's almost spiritual. You know, I mean, it's a little bit transcendent, just from poetry to a really good rhythmic riff that's just incredibly well done.
So I mean, that resonance is, I think it's powerful. But you're right. When I say incredible,
I was talking about Tom's poem.
I know. But you can overdo. I mean, I'm not saying you can't overdo it. You can.
I just thought it was cool.
Well done. You can put up stuff that makes no sense whatsoever if you're not careful. But here, I think the play on the word. It works. I mean, that line. Let me just say that I'm going to remember the one. The other line I'm going to really remember here is that back the coastal waters whoosh pulls off the clothes of the shoreline. Wow,
right.
You know, that's powerful.
Yes,
that's powerful.
Well,
go ahead.
Interesting fact is, I looked on the internet. Or some reason, and I found this poem was published in a newsletter in Sri Lanka.
For anticipating a tsunami, possibly. Yeah, yeah, right.
Wow.
I mean, after the fact.
Oof.
Yeah.
Oof.
And interesting. But it made its way around.
Well, that's, you know, so I like that one a lot. We're going to take a short break, play a little bit of music for a second, and assuming my player there. Something happened to it, so we're going to have to play it from over here. Da, 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 da. Come on here, buddy. Here you go.
But you keep my heart.